Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson: the will of the people is the only legitimate foundation of any government, and to protect its free expression should be our first object. I'm telling you, this guy, if he saw a free speech zone out in front of a Bush rally with people being herded into barbed wire cages, fenced-in cages, by, you know, at gunpoint, and the founders of this country have to be rolling over in their graves. Al Garza is with us. He's a spokesman for the Minutemen Civil Defense Corps. MinutemenHQ.com is their website. Hey, Al, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great. Good talking with you. You guys, I continue. The last time I had, I don't remember if it was you, Al, or if it was somebody else in the Minutemen, but the last time I had one of you guys on, I made the point that you know, I continually make here, is that we don't have an illegal immigrant problem. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States. And the person I spoke with said, oh, yeah, we're on that. We're going to start barricading and blockading and, you know, illegal employers because, you know, I mean, 40% of the illegal people who are in this country who are not citizens and who are here illegally came through legitimate legal border checkpoints. You could build a Berlin Wall across Mexico, and you still have people coming in on tourist visas and staying here over the visa. So have you guys started now putting up human barricades and whatever you would call it around some of the illegal employers in this country?
Oh, absolutely. That's been ongoing. It may have been one of our other spokespeople that mentioned that, but we've been doing this, Tom, for the last couple of years.
Why is it getting no publicity? Why is it always down at the border?
It's obviously going to get no publicity, but if you look back and just a month or so ago, where these busts in Cactus, Texas, and Phoenix, Tucson, and I forget what, I think it was in California, where they busted Swift and these other organizations.
Yeah, but that wasn't you guys who brought that about. That was the Department of Homeland Security, actually.
Well, it actually was them, but we have brought the awareness to it. We have been out there adamantly for the last couple of years. We began this thing, launched it in Tucson, and it's called Operation Spotlight. And then simply saying that what we do is we go out there and we take visuals with cameras, obviously, and we record license plates. We record all the activities that are occurring, and then we report them. That's not to say that they're going to follow up and enforce our laws. But that has been ongoing now for 2 years, and they're getting frustrated, and they have no other choice but to enforce the law now.
Yeah, my biggest objection to what you guys are doing, Al Garza, with MinutemenHQ.com, the Minutemen Civil Defense Corps, is, first of all, let me just put this out. You know, I think everybody, any citizen of any country in the world gets it, particularly any of the developed countries in the world gets it, that you have to maintain a certain numerical relationship between the number of people willing to work and the number of jobs out there in order for there to be a middle class. It's one of the reasons why unions came about, was to control the amount of labor available. It's why we had child labor laws. It's why virtually every country in the world has immigration laws. It's one of the reasons why Mexico so aggressively enforces its immigration laws, as lots of people in their 50s and 60s who are moving down to Mexico to retire and trying to get a part-time job and suddenly finding themselves deported back to the United States are discovering. And Mexico so aggressively protects its southern border. And it's a reason why the United States, you know, should enforce those laws. But those laws don't so much have to do with the border as they do with employers. And it seems to me more often than not that what you guys are all about is this mythical border.
And
you're appealing to a whole group of people who are, oh my God, the brown people are coming. That there's a racist element out there that I think that you guys really need to be disavowing.
Well, that's not very true. I'm impacted. I'm at ground zero. I'm in Arizona. I'm impacted. I mean, it sounds to me like you don't really know about border security. If you did, I'll even challenge you to come over just in my backyard. I have a little ranch where it's completely been dilapidated, vandalized. My truck has been stolen. My garage, my shed has been vandalized. My food out of my refrigerator has been taken, and at one point I thought it was a crazy neighbor. Well, it's not. The borders are completely porous. And I like to hike. My wife and I like to hike. We've been told we can't go out and hike in our own country.
But that border, Al Garza, has been porous for 200 years.
Well,
it's only since we started, since we stopped enforcing immigration.
There is no reason in today's world, post 9/11, why we should be talking about border security. That should have been sealed, like you say, 200 years ago.
It's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that if somebody wants to do us harm, I mean, I heard this argument. Let me finish this sentence here, Alan. I'll give you a full shot at it, okay? I heard this a couple of days ago on one of these talk shows, one of these TV talk shows, where the guy's going, we got to be really careful now because there's people from Al Qaeda who are going down to Mexico and shaving their head and their hair and beards and acquiring a Mexican accent, and then they sneak across the border. You know, if somebody wants to do us harm, are you trying to tell me that the terrorists who are actually competent and sophisticated and intelligent enough to do something like blow up a bomb in a city in the United States or hijack an airplane are so stupid that they would think that they'd have to come across the border in Arizona or Texas illegally when they could just as easily get a phony passport or a visa and come through any U.S. border checkpoint?
Well, you drive a very good point. However, I've been in combat. If it were me, and I am very experienced in combat, and I was a PI for 35 years, so I would look for the weakest points. What are the weakest points? I got virtually 2,000 miles of wide open space. Why would I need a visa?
That's not a weak point, though, to go through that. People die in that desert. That's not a weak point. The weak point.
We have found literature that links 46 countries to the borders. Now, here's what that means. We have found ID cards from Iraq, Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan. The list goes on. Literature.
Yeah, and I would submit to you that, number one, if these folks are actually coming across the border, that they're not the ones that we have to worry about, that they're equally, they're equally bottom of the food chain economically looking for a job.
They're still breaking the law. So you have a fence around your property, Tom?
No, I don't.
Well,
and
I do.
And it's a shame. And I'm there with you, Al. But I got to say, the point of this is that if we stopped being a magnet, if our employers stopped hiring people who are not citizens,
then we
would not have a problem with the border in the South.
That's what we agree.
I mean, Canada. My son recently he's in the process right now of moving to Montreal, where his girlfriend's going to college, and trying to get a part-time job. It's impossible. I mean, they seriously check out your citizenship before you can get a job in Canada, and therefore there's no huge influx of Americans going to Canada to get good jobs and free health care.
Yep.
But there would be if they didn't do that.
Well, it certainly doesn't take no 12 million or 14 million or 40 million for that matter. Nobody really knows what the figures are. But the bottom line is we do agree on that.
Yeah, no, my point is we don't have an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States.
Well,
until we shut down these corporations who want to exploit human beings, until we shut them down and start putting some CEOs in jail, you're not going to see a resolution to this problem. This is all about cheap labor. That's the bottom line here.
One fact.
And that's why the conservatives are so gung-ho about it.
Well,
that's why the Republicans want to have their guest worker program.
Well, that's one facet. That's one facet of it. The other facets are very obvious. There are other magnets, not just employment. The public services, for example. I happen to understand Spanish very well. I write it, I speak it, and I listen very well, and I listen to their stations. And their biggest commercial now, especially in Los Angeles, Tucson, Phoenix, and Austin and Houston and whatnot, their biggest thing now is that it's so easy for them to come in, penetrate our country, and go into the welfare situation. And you can see it day in and day out. I go to the stores and I monitor. One out of every three that goes into that store comes out with groceries paid by our taxpayers. Now, that's not only unfair, that's fraud.
But see, all of that is part of the system that is being sanctioned by the Republicans and the conservatives.
Yeah, but if you take a survey, though, Tom's what I'm really saying. Who is involved? You go down to the welfare.
I'll tell you who's involved with it. Who's involved with making it happen is the high end of the Republican Party and the corporate power structure in this country.
Well, to a certain point, that's true, but
they could stop that in a minute, Al. You know that.
Well, no, I don't know that. I'll tell you what I do know.
You think these guys can't get a law through Congress? You think they can't get the Department of Homeland Security to actually enforce the law? They could do it in a heartbeat.
Well, wait a minute. Are you going to let me talk?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, for 30 seconds.
Okay. What I'm saying is that the people that are in the department that work for social services predominantly are going to be swayed one way, and it's going to be to allow these people to come in and apply, and not only apply, but also obtain public services.
Yeah, but those people's job isn't to be a border security agent. Their job is to make sure that a hungry person has food stamps.
Well, a hungry person, you've got other hungry people like in Africa and other nations. They're not doing that.
No, and I agree. I think that we should open up our immigration in the United States to people who are true refugees, and rather than you know, somebody wants a better job. But anyhow, Al Garza, Minuteman HQ is the website, the Minuteman Civilian Defense Corps. Thanks, Al, for being
with
us.
Okay, buddy.
16 minutes past the hour. And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least a clean election. You know, we'd take good clean elections, because then the will of the people would happen, and the will of the people happened, then we'd see, like, the end of war in Iraq, and we'd see a national health care program, and we'd see the environment get cleaned up, and we'd see good jobs, and you know, the rules of the game of the business might change. And yes. But you got to realize that, you know, back in the days when we had clean elections, we got folks like Franklin Roosevelt. And nowadays,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah. But to bring this back to immigration, bottom line here, as I said, we don't have an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States. 20, 30, 40 years ago, a million people a year came over the border to the north. A million people every year went south over the border. People can't, you know, that in and of itself was problematic. Cesar Chavez and who was the vice presidential candidate? Walter Mondale marched together in the 1960s down to the Mexican border in protest of illegal immigration into the United States. Because the immigrants were competing with the United Farm Workers Union. But the fact of the matter is that it's not about people, and we need to stop criminalizing people, and we need to stop making people the scapegoats. And there's we certainly shouldn't say to somebody, you're hungry, you're thirsty, you're homeless, therefore, but you're not a citizen. Tough. You have a broken leg. Tough luck. I'm sorry. You know, human beings are human beings. And at the same time, by the way, if you want to work in a country, you should be a citizen of the country. Or at least you should work under the rules of the country. You know, have an appropriate visa, work visas and things like that. This all goes back. In 1814, David Ricardo, the famous, probably the third most famous economist in history, David Ricardo, wrote a paper in 1814 called On Labor, in which he put forward what is referred to in Econ 101 classes right now as it's called the Iron Law of Wages. And what Ricardo pointed out was that if you look all through history, what you find is that when the supply of labor is equal to the demand for labor, when the supply of labor slightly exceeds the demand for labor, which is typically the case, that the price of labor falls to what Ricardo called a subsistence level. And his example was Victorian era in England. You have a very, very small ruling class that, you know, a 1% that owns 90% of the wealth. You have a very small middle class, the mercantile class, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the shop owners, and the experts, the physicians and the stonemasons, those who could form guilds. And then you have a very, very large group of the working poor. It's like 80, 90% of the population. And what he pointed out in 1814 in On Labor was that that's the natural state of things in an unregulated economy where the supply of labor is absolutely unlimited. And that's why in the 1880s, the Wobblies started organizing, and so the progressives and the populists and started fighting. You know, the railroads were importing labor from China to work on the railroad to try and break the unions. And yes, those laws that were passed back then were very racist. They said, you know, Chinese can't be imported. But the bottom line is that it was really all about the cost of labor. It was all about what the railroads were trying to do was prevent a middle class from emerging. And what the people, the citizens of this country were trying to do was to say, no, wait a minute. If we want to withhold some of this labor so that you, the employers, have to pay a higher price. And that's what drove the progressives in the late 1800s and the early 1900s to pass laws that made it against the law for children to compete with adults in the workplace. The child law labors, the child labor laws were not passed out of compassion for children. I mean, it was a great excuse, but they were passed by people who wanted to protect their jobs. And the immigration laws in the United States that first got put on the books in a serious way in the 1920s, same deal. And every country in the world does this. So it's not about bad people. And then to compound that issue, we've got these insane policies in the United States that benefit the oligarchy of Mexico and other countries and that benefit the multinational corporations where we say, okay, we're going to throw huge subsidies, for example, into the corn industry. And we're going to have these huge multinational corporations, the corn corporations. We're going to give them billions, tens of billions of dollars of taxpayer subsidies from Americans. And that drives down the cost of corn. So that subsistence farmers in Mexico can't sell their own corn in their own country because you can import corn from the United States cheaper. Now, that's starting to change because of ethanol, but that's, you know, kind of an unanticipated consequence. But the bottom line is that NAFTA, our, you know, part of our foreign policy, that our internal, our domestic agricultural policies, and most importantly, ever since Ronald Reagan came along in 86 and had his amnesty, and, you know, really started in 82 with a wink, wink, nod, nod. You know, yeah, illegal employers, no problem. We're not going to prosecute you. Don't worry. You can hire anybody you want. That what has happened? The cost of labor has gone down in the United States. Since Reagan became president, all the way from the time that in 1935, when Roosevelt first passed the Wagner Act, which now enabled unionization, and we started tightening up the labor market, from that time until 1980, the price of wages continuously went up, and they've been going down ever since. 27 minutes past the hour.
Day by day, I hear the voices rising, starting with a whisper. Like it did before. Day by day, we count the dead and dying. Ship the bodies home. While in him works off each door.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and just click live chat up at the top. It's free. We don't compile any email lists from it. There's no spam. There's no nothing. It's real easy. It's just very simple. Robert in Berkeley, California. Hey, Robert, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. It's very good to hear you. And you said many of the things I was going to say, like NAFTA and the subsidies to Archer Daniel Midland.
So. Yeah, it all has to be taken as a whole. Anybody who tries to say, oh, it's just one thing, like, for example, that there's not a wall along the Mexican border, is just nuts.
I agree with you on that, but I wanted to bring up one point your guest made.
Sure.
He was talking about basically the immigrants cheating on their taxes and other criminal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think if you look at the people that really cheat on their taxes, they're in the upper 10% of the income group in this country.
Well, and here's the ultimate cheating. Those guys got Congress to pass a law and the president to sign it that says that if you make your living working for a living, like I'm assuming you do and I'm doing right now, then you pay a maximum 31, 32, 33%, whatever the top rate is. You pay that in income taxes. But if you make your living sitting around on your butt around the swimming pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive in the mail, you pay a maximum 15% income tax. And, I mean, sweet work if you can get it, right? That's the law now. That was Bush's last tax cut.
It's like the corpse. They got the same kind of deal. What are they paying? 15%?
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. Yeah, corporations have a whole different set of tax laws in there. And, you know, corporations right now are paying about a little less than 10% of the total tax load in most of the United States, and the rest of us are paying the vast majority of it. It wasn't always that way. Brian in Manchester, New Hampshire. Hey, Brian.
Yes, and I believe something like 60 to 65% of corporations, ostensibly American corporations, Tom, pay not one penny in federal income tax each year?
Yeah, although be careful with that number, Brian,
okay,
because the vast majority
all
of those are small companies. You know, I've got a small company that I run the income from my book writing through, you know, and it doesn't,
yeah,
you know, I don't make a fortune writing books, and at the end of the year, I just, you know, make sure that there's no money in that. I don't make any profit on it.
Right.
And I think most small businesses,
yeah,
are run that way.
No, I don't think it, and I don't think, I'm not about to say that every corporation is evil or all, you know, there are,
yeah,
great people like Bill Gates and yourself that might be incorporated.
Well, I'm not in a league with Bill Gates, I'll tell you that.
But these Minutemen, Tom, these Minutemen that are on the border, they
yeah,
spend every day on the border harassing a starving, dehydrated Mexican guys and peasants coming across the border.
I know. This
but
is tragic.
Not every day in front of the Archer Daniel Midland Corporation, their private security firm
yep,
would be on top of them, right on top of them. They're afraid to do that.
Yeah,
they're afraid to do that.
Yeah, and that was my point to them, Brian. That was my point. And I hear them saying, oh, yeah, yeah, we're going to get out there. But, I don't see any evidence of it happening. I really, really don't. Let's see. This is maybe off topic. I'm not sure. But, Doug, if you're in a sit-in at a congressional office, I want to put you on the air right away here. Doug in Campbell, California. Hey, Doug.
Oh.
You're on the air.
Oh, excuse me.
Okay, Doug, I'm going to come back to you here in just a minute. Brad in Gulfport, Mississippi. Hey, Brad, what's up?
Hi, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Brad?
Oh, I just had a good example of the supply and demand of labor that you were talking about a while ago.
Yeah, David Ricardo's 1814 Iron Law of Wages.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Gulfport, Mississippi, before Hurricane Katrina,
right,
somebody could go and get a job at McDonald's, say, and they would pay a minimum wage.
Yeah.
Well, after the hurricane, there was nobody to fill those jobs, so they were getting up to $12 an hour plus incentives.
Yeah.
But since the hurricane spread everybody around, there was nobody to work there, but they still wanted to make money, so they paid everybody more money.
Right.
It's just crazy. It took a hurricane to make people get a living wage.
Yeah, it is. And what's interesting is if you look back in history, you discover that what is normal is not for there to be a middle class. You're spot on, Brad. And what is normal in quotes with absolutely unfettered, laissez-faire, unregulated capitalism, what is normal is for there to be a large class of the working poor and a very small middle class and a very small upper class, and that's pretty much it. And the first middle class in Europe that emerged was after the Black Death, after the plagues in the 1340s, I think it was, and 1350s, and as a result of a third of the population of Europe being wiped out, a middle class emerged because there was so much more demand for labor. The cost of labor went up. That middle class then, people had time, leisure time, for arts and philosophy and science and music, and boom, you had the Renaissance. And then, you know, 200 years later, then it kind of slid back down into the Dark Ages again. And then 200 years later, the Spanish found gold in South America and brought all this gold into Europe. And the wealth ratio increased. All of a sudden, everybody's richer. Another middle class emerged. Well, plus, they found all this land in North America that they were able to steal from the natives, kill them off with diseases like the flu, kill them off by guns, steal their land, and boom, you had another middle class. And that period is referred to as the Enlightenment. And then we had a middle class from 1935 to 1980. But then Ronald Reagan said, oh, wait a minute, middle class, not a good thing. Because in a middle class, people start getting uppity. They start asking for rights. They start demanding things. Okay, Doug and Campbell, you ready to go on the air now?
Hello?
Hey, Doug, what's up?
Hi.
You're on the air.
I'll let you know about the South Bay Occupation Project and more generally the Occupation Project being organized by Voices for Creative Nonviolence.
Okay.
We're sitting in the congresspeople's offices around the country demanding that they pledge to vote against the supplemental appropriation that the White House just introduced today.
Good on you, Doug. And so you're sitting in at whose office?
Representative Mike Honda, he's in the 15th district in California, generally Silicon Valley area.
Yeah, and you're
in
a local office?
Pardon me?
Are you in a local office or are you in Washington, D.C.?
No, we're at the district office in Campbell, California.
Yeah, okay, good. Good.
Yeah.
And if people want to know more about this, is there a website, Doug?
Yeah, there's a website. It's www.vcnv.org. That's Voices for Creative Nonviolence.
Great. vcnv.org. Doug, thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Mary in Palo Alto, California. Hey, Mary.
Hi. I was sitting here when I listened to people that argue with you about, you know, it being an illegal problem as opposed to an employer. I get baffled as to, you know, why they can't see it. But my theory is that it's too awesome for them to, or too hard to think that it's more of a system problem, because that probably, you know, scares the bejesus out of them.
Well, I think there's two things here, Mary. The first is, I don't think most people think systemically. They don't look at a, you know, at an economic system. I mean, they don't understand it. It's not part of their thinking process. And secondly, we're talking in the United States right now at this moment, we're talking about people who are, quote, different. We're talking about people who speak a different language and have slightly different skin color. Although the skin color, I mean, you know, you say the same thing about the Irish and the Italian immigrants in the 1800s in the United States, you know, not getting along, a different language. But I think there's something that's fundamentally human about saying, this is my family, this is my tribe, that's somebody else's family, that's somebody else's tribe, they're different from us. That's probably a normal and healthy thing. But when they're different from us gets morphed into, and therefore we should destroy them, or and therefore we should hurt them, or and therefore we should kill them, or and therefore they're inferior to us, that's when it becomes psychopathological and culturally pathological.
Well, so, don't you think that it's easier for them to think that it would be just the problem with the illegal immigrants, because they could, you know, sort of take them on as opposed to...
Yeah, it's always easiest to look at it at the level of the person, and that's what we need to do is back away from that. We need to help people realize that it's not about the people. These are by and large decent people who are trying to do the best for themselves and for their families. And what we have here is a systemic problem that is being manipulated by fat cats in Washington D.C. at the bottom, and in corporate boardrooms all across America.
But as I listened to you talk to the gentleman earlier, he even seems like he would learned a little bit in what he's doing. It's just so closed off.
Yeah, you would think they're appealing to their base as well, Mary, and that's the tragedy. That's the point that I keep making to him: is stop making your base the racists. Mary, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you, Mike in Dexter, Maine. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. What's happening? Hey, I'm from Dexter. You know, I don't know if you ever heard of Dexter shoes, but they used to be made there and in a couple of small towns around the area. And Warren Buffett's company came in a few years back, or one of his many companies, and bought up Dexter Shoe, and now, like, pretty much a third of the town, well, not so much now, but at the time, a third of the town was out of work, and that really devastated the area, because there were other little plants around the, you know, in surrounding towns that also were devastated by this. And
sure. And the people who were making money making shoes were then spending that money in the local stores and the local shoe companies.
Exactly.
Were using the local accountants and the local lawyers. And,
exactly.
Yeah.
People had to move away. I mean, a lot of my friends' parents had to move away. My mother actually moved out of the town.
Yeah, this is the insanity of our trade deals. We've got about 20 seconds left, Mike. You wanted to tie this into immigration, or do you just want to make that point?
Well, it was about the labor thing you were talking about earlier and shipping. Like, basically now all the work's done in China and I believe the Dominican Republic.
Right.
And Warren Buffett, as a nice guy, took all that money he made and donated it back to people. So he impoverished people to help people out.
He's a good capitalist and a good liberal, which is kind of a messy combination. Mike, thanks for the call. And yes, we did not end slavery in the United States. I'm sorry. People think we ended slavery. We didn't. We simply exported it. It's happening over in China now, and they are our slaves. 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman program, the True People's Radio.
Now I see everything.
We've got to be the ones who make the change, my friends. Welcome back. Get active. Get activist. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour in the chat room, Blue in Missouri says we can put Bush in a skirt and let Higgins go after him. My cat Higgins. Anybody who walks into our house wearing a skirt, he goes crazy. He thinks it's the enemy. I think it's because, you know, 30-some-odd years, Louise and I have been married, and, what, you wear a skirt three times a year, maybe? I don't know. Whatever it is, I just don't know. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Ben, driving in Tennessee. Hey, Ben, welcome to the program.
Yes, how are you doing there, Tom?
Good.
I've been listening to you for a while here. I wanted to kind of speak on the taxes for a little bit. I took civics when I was in school, and our FICA taxes went to Washington, D.C., and they turned around and they distributed it back to the states. When they gave that 1% tax breaks to the rich people, what most people don't realize is that that only made the states raise the taxes up. So that
sure.
means the poor people had to kick in more money. So rather than paying the 35-cent taxes, we got kicked around with more taxes on our food, our license plates, everything else. So
yeah, no, it's happening. It's happening all over the country, Ben. It's Bush's tax cuts for the rich are echoing through. I mean, they're harming our soldiers in Iraq. They're harming this nation. The local communities are having to raise fees and license everything. Absolutely spot on. 1-866-440-8466. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin.
Let's put it down to this level. First,
yes, sir.
I think we need a border and a wall. I think we need
Why?
To find the employers to keep out terrorists and everybody we don't know is innocent.
Armin, you really think a terrorist is so stupid that they've got to go to the Mexican border when they can just show up at the port of New York and say, here I am, here's my visa? The Saudi royal government, you know, the Bush family and their buddies, the Saudi royal government,
Tom,
they'll give them a visa.
Tom, the guerrilla war is winning for the citizens of Iraq against our occupation army right now. It's the guerrilla war that's winning, and the guerrilla war's in our southern borders. They can come up here and they
But it's not a war, Armin. They're not shooting at us. They're not trying to take us out. They just want jobs.
Listen to me. Listen, please. We've done it this way, the corporate Republican and Democratic way, and it's not working. We need to find the employers, put the wall up, and we need to tell illegals that are non-citizens you're not getting a free ride if you come here, because where is it fair, free, or constitutional to enslave citizens that were born here for the benefit of non-citizens?
Or to enslave the non-citizens, for that matter, with this phony guest worker program. Yes, but, you know, putting up a wall, come on. Are the Canadians building a wall right now so that we won't go there and get free health care? No, they're not. They're not. It's just Eric in New York City. Hey, Eric, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I've talked to you several times before, and once on this subject. I heard you made a call for the Minutemen to disavow their whatever their racist base that you call it. Meanwhile,
yeah.
you're speaking to a Latino Minuteman. And I mentioned to you, Screener, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Latino, I'm strictly anti-illegal. But if you're going to do that, you have to at least call for these organizations like RASA and MALDEF and, frankly, the ACLU, who are basically supporting criminal behavior. It's criminal entry, and I know a lot of them are here looking for jobs, but a lot of them are here are basically criminals. It's a kind of...
Eric, I'm with you. I am entirely in favor of a nation of all nations, and I've lived and worked in several nations, and so I've done this. I've gone through the whole song and dance. I went through a 6-month process to get a work visa to work in Germany for a year. I've been there and done that. I'm all in favor of countries protecting the integrity of their workforce.
What about LaRaza? I don't hear you calling for LaRaza to disavow theft of social services.
I'm sorry, I don't know what LaRaza is.
It's one of these basically social organizations that are like MALDEF, the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund. I mean,
yeah.
they're about to start lobbying Congress to completely not even enforce our border laws. Not even they don't even want to ship back criminals.
Well, if that's their position, Eric, I disagree with it. I'll just put it right out there. I disagree with it. Jim in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Hey, Jim.
Hey, how are you doing?
Fine. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to comment. I keep hearing all these people call that you talk to, the Minutemen, and they're talking about the fact that none of these people pay any income tax.
Actually, nobody has said that today. Immigrants pay a lot of taxes.
Right, and they don't get any of that money back because most of them aren't filing income tax returns.
Right.
So that's just a slush fund that our government gets to keep for, you know, to do with what they...
Which, A, if it's an actual surplus, is equally wrong. It's another exploitation of people who are already exploited. And, B, if the right-wing talking points are correct, right-wing is even the wrong word, if Lou Dobbs' talking points are correct, the amount of social services being used by people in this country illegally is greater, you know, represents a greater number of dollars, total dollars, than the amount that they're being that is being paid into that will never be recovered with Social Security and income taxes and things like that. I frankly don't know either way. I just think that a country, any country, including the United States, has an obligation to protect its workforce. Go ahead.
I do agree with that.
Okay. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, that's really what it boils down to for me. It's all about the cost of labor. And, you know, frankly, I'm very disappointed that the Democratic Party and many of our unions are saying, hey, you know, we're just, you know, guest worker programs, that's fine. You know, we'll get, you know, I think that we need to get back to the fundamentals. The Wobblies had it right. The early progressives had it right. The union movement had it right. Cesar Chavez had it right. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, what's the FCC going to be doing? We're going to be talking with Mark Lloyd of the Center for American Progress. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. What's the state of the media in America today, and why is it that state? Mark Lloyd has some serious opinions on this. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Their website, of course, is americanprogress.org. Mark, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here with us. You wrote a great piece titled "Why the FCC Will Get Media Ownership Wrong Again and What They Should Do to Get It Right." And I think the kernel of this entire piece was, "What is the public good?" Give us the frame here.
Well, part of the challenge that the FCC has is that at least as of last 20 years or so, they've been looking at media in terms of its profitability. So are the radio stations and the television stations making money? And if they are, then the FCC says, well, you know, I guess that's all right. What we're arguing is that the FCC needs to begin to look at whether or not media is actually serving our democracy, whether or not, in other words, local media is actually providing information for local citizens to find out what's going on in local and state governments, as well as what's happening in the federal government and internationally.
Right, and the fact of the matter is that they should be able to do that profitably.
Yeah.
You know, I'll say, you know, the station that I'm broadcasting from right now, KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, it's a clear channel station. I do a local show before I do this national show, and it's profitable. They're making money.
Yeah, well, you should be able to do both.
Yeah, and we do, you know, we do local topics, and it's, you know, station. So anyhow, as you were saying.
Well, part of what we've found, sort of looking at a variety of markets around the country, is that news is disappearing. Local news is even disappearing more. So we've got a lot of national news sort of being fed through a lot of local stations to pretend that they're actually providing news. But, again, the biggest problem is that the FCC, which is supposed to be reporting to Congress on this, is saying things are going fine, again, as long as these local stations make money. But they're not looking at all at whether or not the local stations are actually serving local public interest.
Now, isn't the larger issue really that FCC is supposed to be reporting to us, to we the people, through Congress, that Congress is the representative of the people, and that the mandate of the Federal Communications Commission should be to make sure that the public interest is served rather than merely the corporate interest?
That's absolutely right. And there are two challenges here. One is that we need more people to put pressure on members of Congress so that members of Congress are actually representing us about what's going on with local media. So So in other words, we need to be able to complain to our local representative about the fact that, you know, they are spending money on the FCC, that they are authorizing the FCC to do certain things, and we're not holding our local representatives accountable for what the FCC is doing, and we've got to.
Isn't this part of a larger issue, Ken? Mark Lloyd. The larger issue being that there was a time in this country, in 1881, the December of 1881, Senator Sherman from Ohio introduced Senate Bill Number 1, which became the Sherman Antitrust Act, where we figured out, we the people figured out that robber barons essentially were not healthy to democracy, and that large corporate conglomerates, whether they be in the media or whether they be in the oil industry, were not healthy for democracy. And there was an attempt made, and you know, it's kind of come and go in cycles over the years. Teddy Roosevelt used it very effectively, and from, you know, 1902 to around 1908, and then it kind of went away during the time leading up to the Republican Great Depression, and then Franklin Roosevelt started using it very effectively again, and even Eisenhower was enforcing the Sherman Act, and then Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in 1981, which led to the mergers and acquisition mania right across industries, right across the board, the whole Michael Milken thing, you know, all these, and these giant conglomerates were formed. And ultimately, it's not good for capitalism, and even worse, it's not good for democracy.
Well, you're talking about an area that I love, actually. So I just wrote a book, or published a book called Prologue to a Farce, Communication and Democracy in America. It's being published by the University of Illinois Press. Just came out a couple weeks ago.
Good on you. Is there a website I can point people to for it?
If you go to Amazon.com and look up Mark Lloyd and look at Prologue to a Farce, you'll find it.
Great.
There's an article that I wrote on the American Progress website called Whatever Happened to Antitrust.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with antitrust law historically is that it has almost never served the public interest where media or broadcasting is concerned. And what I look at specifically is the giant AT&T SBC merger that the FCC has just approved. Again, this is actually fairly typical insofar as a giant media is concerned. But the biggest problems, which we thought were actually corrected in the late 1960s and early 70s, is that for the most part, the public was not even included in decision-making regarding what broadcasters were doing. To some limited extent, they were included in what the local public utility commissioners were doing regarding telephone stuff, but it was very limited. It wasn't until the late 1960s, a civil rights case called the United Church of Christ v. FCC, that the courts finally determined that the public actually had a right to complain about what local radio stations and television stations were doing in their local area. And the public was finally given some power. The Reagan administration essentially cut away all of those rights and protections that were put in place in the early 1970s. By 1984, it was all gone.
Yeah, it was like Jimmy Carter was the last guy to seriously enforce the Sherman Act, busting up AT&T.
Harold Green with the modified judgment, and we shouldn't get me started talking about this stuff.
It's time to break it back. I mean, you know, it's time to bring it back. I mean, we had a time. There was a time in the United States when the robber barons were called the robber barons, regardless of industry. When people got it that the interests of average persons were not always served by huge conglomerates. And now I think at a certain subliminal level, people get it that maybe their interests or the interests of American democracy are not served, particularly when they reflect on how we got led into the war in Iraq, are not served by having a defense contractor, for example, on, you know, a major broadcast network plus a major cable network. But they don't know what to do about it. They don't know the history of all this stuff. They don't have a sense of it.
That's right. Well, you got to read my book, Prologue to a Farce. You can't forget the name. It's
yeah,
a quote
okay.
by James Madison.
Yeah, okay.
And, again, it looks at the history of communications policy in the U.S. The big challenge, unfortunately, with antitrust law is that it has almost never made a difference except when it was enforced or brought to bear by private corporations against other private corporations.
Hmm.
Regarding the public interest, it has almost always meant almost nothing. The last person who did anything regarding antitrust was Joel Klein, who worked under the Clinton administration and brought a successful suit with a variety of other state's attorney generals
But to bring this back to the media, Mark Lloyd, we only have a couple of minutes left here. Back in the 1970s, in the early 1970s, I worked in radio in Michigan, and
oh, so did I.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, in I was in Lansing. And
I was working in Ann Arbor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Well, I was in Lansing at WITL and WJIM TV and WVIC, and anyway, and WITL, the radio, one of the radio stations that I worked at, I did news for them for years,
mm-hmm.
and there's no doubt in my mind, I mean, they complained about it at the time, that they lost money on their news operation. But they did it because they were required to provide public service, and the local news was perceived as part of that public service.
That's absolutely right.
When did that go away? How do we bring that back?
It went away in 1984 with a little notice rulemaking, revising the programming rules. Programming rules were put in place in 1960. Again, they meant almost nothing until the late 1960s when the public had the right to complain about them. But again, we had this very short period of time from roughly the late 1960s or early 1970s to about 1984. When
so Reagan pulled the plug on this thing.
All that stuff was eliminated.
Yeah, and Reagan pulling the plug on it, was it similar to his motivation? I mean, Reagan was once asked why he essentially did away with free public education in California, the University of California system, and his comment was, why should I pay through my taxes, the tuition of people who are going to go out and protest things that I disagree with? Was this change similar that, the news media, a wide open news media and help in a way help bring down the Vietnam War? You think it had something to do with that?
Well, there was certainly a campaign against news media, again, against the so-called liberal bias.
Yeah. Well, there still is. Mark Lloyd, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. You can read all about it over AmericanProgress.org. You can find his book online and Amazon, whatever. Mark Lloyd, Lloyd. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
There's a dark and a troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view.
And welcome back, my friends, to the place where despair is not an option. Get active! 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And speaking to the media, time now for a Rush Alert!
With condescending fries, making money, selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts.
His guts.
I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic guts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
That's right.
I really am.
So our Rush Alert for the day, here we go.
Now we've got polar bears, stranded polar bears, animals, essence of innocence. So cute, so lonely.
Let's keep in mind the context here, the photo of the polar bears floating out in the Arctic ice, preparing to die because of global warming. And we're hearing now from one of America's great global warming deniers.
So frightened, so panicked, bellowing out for hope from the nearest human. Meanwhile, the Canadian film crew are just content to let them float off to their deaths for the sake of grabbing the photo to mislead you. And your kids, who will no doubt be shown this by a bunch of worthless teachers who are promoting a political agenda.
Yes, those worthless unionized teachers. How dare they? How dare they make a decent living wage in America and be members of a union? No, we can't have that.
Yes, what's the question? They cancel your Senate and swim hundreds of miles. This whole thing is totally misleading. They're not even stranded on an ice floe that's broken apart. They're just out. They're just playing around. They're just out there. You know, just like your cat goes to its litter box. When's the last time your cat got stranded in its litter box? Just like your pit bull attacks and kills the neighbor's baby horse. Whatever. I mean, these things happen. I mean, it's called nature.
Yeah, well, here's what actually is going on, Rush, just to set the record straight. It's from the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org. Polar bears are drowning because climate change is melting the Arctic ice shelf. Researchers were startled to find bears have to swim up to 60 miles across open sea to find food. They're being forced into the long voyages because the ice floes from which they feed are melting, becoming smaller and drifting farther apart. Pregnant polar bears in Alaska, which spend most of their lives on sea ice, are increasingly giving birth on land, according to researchers. Why? Global warming. Polar bears may be turning to cannibalism because longer seasons without ice keep them from getting to their natural food. In December, the Bush administration, however, decided to propose listing the polar bear as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, putting the U.S. government on record as saying that the global warming, this is the New York Times, could drive one of the world's most recognizable animals out of existence.
In closing, let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob. I'm the copper, the cop, the Joe McCarthy-like Gestapo, the right-wing, foam-of-the-mouth, jack-booted slob, the Democrat.
Oh, maybe it's just that the polar bears are pining for the fjords, you think? They're just pining for the fjords. Yes, indeed. Well, who knows? In any case, John Edwards, big headline over at the right-wing drudge site, Edwards, raise taxes. Well, yeah. Here's the problem. What John Edwards was saying was, let's have a national health care plan. And somebody's going to have to pay for it. The fact of the matter is, we're already paying for it. We're paying about $6,000 per person in the United States for health care. And that's everybody, but everybody's not covered. Canada pays about $3,000 per person, and everybody is covered. What makes the difference? The difference is the fact that in the United States, we've got people like William McGuire, the former head of the second largest healthcare company in the United States, pulling a $1.78 billion paycheck. The difference is that we've got a whole series of corporations that have inserted themselves between you and your doctor, between you and your hospital, between you and the drugs that you need to keep you alive if you're in a condition where you need pharmaceuticals to stay alive, who have inserted yourself in the middle, and they have a whole bunch of people whose primary job is to make sure that you don't that you don't get the services or that the people who are providing them to you don't get paid. I mean, it's incredible. The state of health care in the United States is an absolute disaster. And these people are sucking all this money out of the system. They've got all these people whose job is to call up and say, I don't think we can cover this. Or let's send out three more notices before we finally send out the bill in the hopes that they forget about it. Or let's let them know that, you know, if they haven't responded to this, then we're not going to pay it. And on and on it goes. Right? It's a scam. It's a it's a trillion-dollar scam in the United States. We have a health care system that is pulling anywhere from 25 to 35% of every health care dollar. 25 to 35 cents out of every healthcare dollar through our private for-profit healthcare system is going to pay for CEO salaries, for stockholder dividends, for marketing, advertising, promotion, and fancy headquarters. Whereas with Medicare, only $3 of every $100 or 3 cents out of every dollar goes to pay for the cost of administration. And John Edwards just pointed it out. Got good on him. 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back to the pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. The feds are collecting DNA at every arrest now. This was a little-known provision slipped into the Violence Against Women Act. Up until now, federal authorities had taken DNA samples from convicted felons. Now it's anybody arrested. I don't know. I'm ambivalent about it. I think that in Canada, for example, the media, and this isn't a law, it's simply a policy that the media follows, but they're quite scrupulous about following it. They don't release the name of people who have been charged with crimes on the assumption that people are innocent until proven guilty. So if Joe Blow gets arrested for robbing a bank, Joe Blow's name is not made public. They just say, you know, a suspect was arrested today for robbing a bank. When Joe goes to trial and gets convicted, then they say, Joe Blow was sentenced to 12 years today for robbing a bank. He's now a criminal. So his name makes the newspaper. But before, he's not a criminal. His name doesn't make the newspaper. There's this presumption of innocence. The Fourth Amendment talks about our right to privacy and our person's place, papers and things, unless there is probable cause that we're committing a crime, which presumably would lead to an arrest. And see, that's where it gets into the gray area, because if there's probable cause, then maybe you should be searched. But do we really want the feds building this massive database? And frankly, my biggest concern about this isn't so much that they've gone from taking DNA samples from felons to now taking DNA samples of people that are arrested, but that the next stop will be that they're going to take DNA samples every time they stop you for a parking ticket or traffic ticket. Here, stick this swab in your mouth, and then pretty soon it's going to be, oh, you want your driver's license renewed? Here, stick this swab in your mouth, and then pretty soon it's all of us. And do we really want to live in a country where you're assumed guilty and you have to prove your innocence? I don't think so. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, 440-THOM, Linda in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Hey, Linda, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. It's good to talk to you, and thanks for being on the air. I love it.
Thank you.
But, you know, I've been listening to you talk about the whole immigration process this morning, and my husband and I have just been married for a couple of months, and he's just immigrated from England.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been through a process that has just been outrageous. First, I had to apply so he could apply.
Let me tell you about it. My brother-in-law, my wife's brother, married a woman from Asia and 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And she's about a third of the way through the process that she's going to have to go through to become a U.S. citizen. It's going to take her 6 years.
It's amazing. Well, now that Ed came in November, he finally got his fiancé visa, and that was a process unto himself. He had to prove that he'd never been so much as thrown a piece of gum on the ground, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through that, and all the money that it took to get that into process was amazing. The amount of repetitive forms that we filled out were amazing. This man's had his fingerprints taken, I can't tell you how many times. He's had his photograph taken, I can't tell you how many times. And now that he's here, we can apply for him to have permanent residency. We began that.
Which then makes him eligible to work.
Exactly.
Right.
And
that's the crux of it all. I mean, the reason why we have such a rigorous immigration process with England is that we don't want to dilute our labor force with people who would compete with our workers.
Right. But, you know, when you think about the people that want to come into this country legally and be workers, be taxpayers, be upstanding citizens, we put every single roadblock in the way that we possibly can.
Right.
Not to mention, I can't imagine what it would be like for someone who was illiterate, who didn't speak the language, and didn't have a cent in their pocket.
Well, but see, here's where it flips around, Linda. Somebody who's illiterate, doesn't speak the language, and doesn't have a cent in their pocket is somebody who is very easily exploited by large corporations.
Exactly.
Your husband, who is literate, who speaks English, and who presumably has at least a high school education if he grew up in a fully developed European country,
mm-hmm.
is somebody who can compete on the level playing field of the American worker. And so from the corporate point of view, your husband is not as desirable an employee as somebody who is illiterate and doesn't speak English, because they can pay that person a whole lot less. And that's why they're pushing so hard to let people who sneak across the border become citizens or guest workers very quickly, whereas they want your husband to take more time because he's going to want a bigger paycheck.
Well, true. But I feel...
This is all about cheap labor, Linda. It's all about cheap labor.
It is, and my heart goes out to those people because they would never make it through the process even if they wanted to.
Yeah.
To be here legally.
Well, actually, a lot of them do. I believe that we let into the country, well, I'm not sure of the number. I was going to say 50,000. Mexican citizens a year. I frankly don't remember the exact number, but we do have a threshold, and it's a fairly high threshold for the number of people that we allow to legally emigrate to the United States from Mexico every year.
Mm-hmm.
But other South American countries as well. And frankly, I think that we should open up and make the process a little easier for a lot of nationalities. I mean, we've got, for example, a meltdown situation going on in Darfur right now. And there are places in the world where people are really, truly, I mean, you know, real genuine refugees and really and truly in need of being rescued. And to the extent that we want to rescue people around the world, I don't think that we should be going in like we did in Iraq and saying, oh, we're going to bring you democracy. But we can be a place of last resort. I mean, it was a terrible thing that we did during World War II in saying to the Jews of Europe, no, you can't come here, for example.
Right.
We should be a place of refuge.
I agree, but not just, and
we should be a place where if you want to marry somebody, you can become a citizen without it taking 10 years.
Well, but, this is true. And right now he's just sitting around twiddling his thumbs until we can actually go to Hartford in a couple of weeks and he can get a chance to get his fingerprints taken one more time. And then at the same time we got to notice that because things seem to be backed up in Missouri, who happens to be handling his case at that center, to try to expedite it a little bit, they've sent his case off to California.
Amazing.
So God bless them for having all these centers.
Yeah, indeed.
In the meantime, I'm happy to say that one of the things he's doing to keep himself occupied is he's volunteering at a local Valley Free Radio.
Oh, that's great. That's
so
great. That's so good on him.
Things are moving on.
There you go. Now, Linda, you made your point. You made it well, and I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. I do have to move along here. Leonard in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Leonard.
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Hey, I just want to call and tell you, got back from Iraq last year, couldn't afford medical insurance for my daughter and myself, but we do have dental. So if we get cancer and die of cancer, we're going to die with good teeth down here. And
as an Iraqi vet, don't you qualify for Veterans Administration coverage?
Well, the fact of the matter is, what they do is, it depends on how much money you make, but I'm not, you know what, I could probably qualify, but I'm not going to do it if my daughter can't. I know it's illogical, but I just can't stand the fact that she could have anything wrong with her, and I can't even afford it as a public.
No, it makes perfect sense. I mean, this gets back to what John Edwards was talking about this weekend. We need a national health care system in this program.
I just want to let you know, I'm praying that everybody out there understands that Arizona, John McCain is not representing most of the citizens here now, and he speaks the stupidity and the illogic of it's great to have a surge and back Mr. Bush, because a lot of us out here in the progressive community and in conservative community, believe it or not, can't stand John McCain. So please, I'm hoping the rest of the world knows John McCain will soon hopefully have a recall on him, and keep your eyes open for that. Thank you.
Okay, good on you, Leonard. Adios. Adios. Thanks a lot for the calls. That's interesting. You know, Joe Klein just came out with this thing, the Time magazine columnist, talking about how McCain, whether you agree with him or not, has been entirely consistent about the war. And as they point out over at the Think Progress blog, McCain called for sending another 20,000 troops to Iraq. He endorsed Bush's escalation strategy, but later claimed, I would have liked to have sent more. And he claimed that the war was going easy, had been easy, except that he knew it was probably going to be long and hard and tough. He claimed that he bitterly disagreed with the Iraq strategy from the beginning, except when he earlier said, we'll have made a fair amount of progress if we stay the course. He was for withdrawing U.S. troops to the border of Iraq if escalation failed, but then later backtracked, saying he would only reconsider redeployment if we have the situation under control. He wants to establish benchmarks for the Iraqi government, but can't tell you what they are. He said the escalation could not bring about results in a few months, but then claimed, I think in the case of the Iraqi government cooperation and doing what's necessary, we'll know fairly well within a few months. Yeah. Okay, that and also our issue of privacy. Do you want the feds taking your DNA? Bill in Bement. Is it Bement, Illinois? Am I pronouncing that right, Bill?
Yeah, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Bill?
Well, anyway, I called about, besides what you're talking about, the DNA, there's been this drug testing going on for a long, long time.
Yeah, which is another you're guilty until you prove yourself innocent thing that seems to be unconstitutional.
Yeah, well, see, I'm caught up right now, and the reason I can call you today is I don't have a job because my union now has a draconian random drug testing program. I'm a construction worker in the laborers union.
Uh-huh.
And it's a totally random thing. I got caught in December And what's really funny is if you have a job, they can't get you fired or laid off. But once you lose that job, you can't get another one until you satisfy them.
Interesting.
And this is the union. I've been a member of this union for almost 30 years. I've only had to be treated for relatively minor injuries on the job 3 times, and I'm a labor activist, and I'm so disgusted now, I'm to the point where I don't even care for unions now.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Bill, and I'm sorry to hear that the union has gone to the dark side in that regard. I got to tell you a story about my friend Stanley when we come back from the break, and we'll continue taking your calls. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 45 minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes and airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio. 9.5 minutes before the hour, supported by you, our listeners. Listening carefully for the sponsors of your local affiliate, your local radio station. Find out who those folks are and patronize them. Buy their products. Let them know you're listening. As well as our national sponsors, of course, folks like Sacred Grounds Coffee, all organic, all fair trade, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, all the latest iPods and Mac things, smalldog.com, Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com, and Purina One Natural Blends, 1-866-380-MEOW. It's 9.5 minutes before us. Now we're down to 9 minutes before the hour. I promised you my Stanley story. This is just a real quickie. And then Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service is going to be with us. Apropos of our last caller, we've been talking about DNA collections and drug testing and just this whole invasion of our lives by government. And in my opinion, at a certain level, this is driven by corporate profits, pure and simple. Back in the 70s, I was involved in one of the owners of a company that made herbal teas, and I had a friend who was lived out in California, who was manufacturing drug testing kits. And it's a whole long story how we met and all this stuff. His name was Stanley. And Stanley was selling these things in High Times magazine. He was selling them so that you could find out how pure your pot was, right? And he was like running out of his bedroom kind of thing. You know, it was a small business. And somehow he got some company to start testing, to start using his stuff, and this was like 5, 10, 15 cents worth of chemicals that he was selling retail through High Times magazine for like 10 bucks. He was making a very good profit. I mean, it was a nice little business. He got some company to start drug testing their employees. And then suddenly this thing, like all of a sudden, became a really big deal. Stanley sold out his company to a large multinational corporation who shall remain nameless, frankly, because I can't remember which one it was. But you'd recognize the name. It was one of the drug companies. And he sold out his little company for some, you know, mind-boggling amount of money. I mean, it was millions and millions of dollars. And this was back, you know, when millions and millions was actually millions and millions of dollars. And they started lobbying Congress. And they were lobbying state legislatures. So we got to have this mandatory drug test. We got to have it. No studies, no tests, nothing proving that it actually serves the public good. But it has become a multi-billion dollar industry. And that's what it's all about, in my opinion. Anyhow, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us, talkradionews.com, the website. Victoria, what's happening in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, we've got two things going on today. One is that the president's released his budget. And the other one is that there's a showdown possible on the Senate floor because they can't agree among themselves. Mostly Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid can't agree on what the rules are going to be for the floor debate on the Iraq resolution.
Is this a subtle way on Mitch McConnell's part of filibustering this deal?
Yes.
Yeah. So rather than saying I'm going to use the rules of filibuster and, you know, you're going to have 60 votes to break this thing, he's simply going to say, I'm going to use the rule of we get to decide the rules?
Well, what happens is that this gets technical, and I don't entirely understand it, but there's a cloture vote at 5:30.
Right. Cloture is when they basically say, okay, enough discussion already, or let's end the discussion.
Right. Now, if they don't have enough votes, then they won't have the Iraq debate, and they must move on to other business.
But invoking cloture requires 60 votes, doesn't it?
Correct.
So if there's a cloture vote, then by by virtually by definition, there's a filibuster going on, because if it takes 60...
That's right. That's right. Now, other people behind the scenes apparently are saying, no, that this is just posturing on the two sides and they will come to some kind of a deal.
Interesting.
But you see, these are not things that Harry Reid wants in the resolution. What McConnell wants is he wants this McCain and Lindsey Graham alternative, which is right. Where they back the surge plan, and then they set out benchmarks for progress. And then you've got also this one by Senator Judd Gregg from New Hampshire saying that the U.S. military mission in Iraq will not have its funding cut off.
Right. This is the death of 1,000 paper cuts. The bottom line here.
This is the way it might go down that way.
And Dianne Feinstein over the weekend was saying, you know, if this happens, then something much more serious is going to come down the road. Do you think that she was right?
Yes, I think she probably was.
Yeah, interesting. The president's budget.
Yes.
The early reports that the New York Times had a piece on it just an hour or so ago. One of the senators referred to sticker shock.
Yes, I think that's probably fairly accurate. I mean, people are only just now starting to react to it. It came out at 10. It's the size of massive phone books. You know, you need to get a forklift to carry it around. And we were briefed on it at noon by Rob Portman, director of the Office of Management and Budget. And I sat there for an hour. I took some notes, but I have to tell you, Tom, not only did I not understand what he said, I didn't understand my notes.
Well, I think that's the purpose of the way that they organize the stuff.
Probably is.
Yeah, we definitely don't want you to know what we're talking about after all. You know,
but they did insist that they're being far more transparent.
Yeah, right. But the bottom line is, once again, we're going to have another budget deficit. We're going to borrow more money from our children and our grandchildren so that Bush can have his tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires.
But we'll balance the budget by 2012.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and if you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you.
Yeah.
And
I'm telling you what he's selling me.
Yeah, yeah. And on top of that, not only are we going to maintain our tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, but they're also going to cut funding for Medicaid and Medicare?
That's right. Now, they're not calling it a cut. They're calling it, these are my words, really, but a slight slowdown in the increase.
Yeah, while at the same time inflation is happening. And
right.
Medical inflation is happening pretty radically.
Right.
Yeah, so
then there's a children's health program that's being cut.
The CHIPS programs.
That's correct.
Wow. Amazing. Well, I suppose we shouldn't be surprised. It's going to be really interesting to see how Congress deals with this. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where smart people get their news. 1-866-440-THOM. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, hang out with some of the finest minds on the Internet. We'll be back with more news of the day and your calls. Right after this.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
All right, I guess it's time to play the Death Star music. I don't know, is it the Death Star or is it the Twilight Zone? It's Ralph Nader, former presidential candidate Ralph Nader, the guy that I voted for in 2000. Yes, what can I say? Sometimes you just have to confess. Anyhow, Ralph Nader on Sunday left the door open for another possible White House bid in 2008 and criticized Democratic frontrunner Hillary Rodham Clinton as a panderer and a flatterer. When he was asked on Late Edition, Wolf Blitzer's show, would you consider running? He says, I'll consider it later in the year. He's 72 years old. He did take a few swipes, though, at Hillary Clinton. He said, I don't think she has the fortitude. Actually, she's really a panderer and a flatterer. As she goes around the country, you'll see more of that. Interesting. And then he says, I think her main problem may well be right in New York City. Michael Bloomberg. They're talking in the Bloomberg camp about a possible run. Say, what? I thought Michael Bloomberg was a Republican. Did he change? Is he going to run? Oh, maybe Nader means Bloomberg versus Giuliani versus, you know, I don't get it. This is the first I've heard of this. He says, I'm saying he'll get more diversity for sure. And he'll focus on urban problems. But I say, but I might say he's got the money to do it. Yeah. Yeah, he paid about $70 per vote to become mayor of New York City. Nader went on to say that if Mike Gravel, the senator from Alaska, the former senator from Alaska, or if the congressman from Ohio, my old friend Dennis Kucinich, decide to run, that he will not enter the race, apparently. He says he likes them. He says these people have records, not just rhetoric. And he talks about the corrosive influence of money in politics. And that was actually why I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000, was we lived in Vermont. I knew Louise and I split our votes. She voted for Al Gore. I voted for Nader. And we knew it was a blue state. We knew Al Gore was going to take Vermont with the Electoral College. And I wanted the Green Party, which he was in 2000. He was not in 2004. I wanted the Green Party to get those federal matching funds. And for that, they had to hit a certain minimum. Threshold. But in the 2004 election, when Ralph was running for office, I had him on this program a couple of times and just was not going to put up with it. Republics and democracies and all this kind of stuff, and looking at the Iroquois Confederacy and translating their constitution, everything. And they put together what they think is a pretty good system. But then he looks at it and he goes, he says, you know, this first-past-the-post, winner-take-all stuff, what this means is that if two people run, because it's winner-take-all, first-past-the-post, if two people run to represent a particular area and one person gets 51% of the vote, then you can argue that a majority of the voters are represented. But if three people run, then you don't have a majority of the people represented. And if you have three political parties, three factions participating, you could have somebody who represents 34% of the people who ends up as, you know, governor, senator, president. And if you had four parties, you could have 26% only being represented. You had five parties, it would be 21%. Six parties, it would be what, 17%, something like that. And so what did Madison do? I mean, he couldn't figure out the solution to this problem. So he writes Federalist number, whichever one it is, 10 or 14, or maybe it's 24. I'd have to go back and look. In any case, he writes in the Federalist Papers, please don't form factions. About the evil of political parties. Now, this is in 1787. Keep in mind, 5 years later, 7 years later, James Madison is a member of Thomas Jefferson's Democratic Republican Party. He's not just a partisan. He's running for president after Jefferson leaves office in 1808. He's the next president, 1809, on the Democratic-Republican ticket, what we call the Democratic Party today. And at the end of his life, I mean, he's looking back going, well, okay, this is what we've got. But basically what he realized was we had a two-party system in this country, and there's no way around it. Now, in 1861, John Stuart Mill came along, and he said, I got a solution. I have a way around this. It's really simple. What you do is instead of having, you can have as many political parties as you want, but instead of having first-past-the-post, winner-take-all elections, you have elections that represent proportionally the vote. So if you have 100 seats in Parliament and your party gets 22% of the vote, you get 22 seats. Your party gets 5% of the vote, you get 5 seats. Your party gets 30% of the vote, you get 30 seats. And so in 1861, John Stuart Mill invented proportional representation. At that time, there were only a handful of democracies in the world. In fact, the American Civil War was really kind of a turning point. Throughout the early part of the 1800s, most of the countries of the world, the aristocracies of the world, the more developed countries, looked at us and said, well, you know, it's a nice experiment, but look what happened when the French tried it. You know, Maximilian Robespierre and the terrors and everything else. We don't want that. And then the Civil War happened, and they were all going, see, told you so. Democracies can't survive. And after the Civil War and during Reconstruction, you saw this rise in democracies all around the world from a half a dozen or so to more or less 100 now, depending on how you define a democracy. And with the exception of Greece and arguably England and Canada to a certain extent, Australia and New Zealand, with the exception of basically those five countries, all of them use proportional representation. So I get Ralph Nader on my program here about 2 years ago. He's running for president. And he tries this canard. He says, well, you know, if Israel can have five political parties, if Germany can have six political parties, if France can have seven political, why can't we have a third political party in America? And, you know, the problem is all over America, there's people who don't understand the history of this, and they don't understand the difference between first-past-the-post winner-take-all like we have and what proportional representation is, and the fact that all of these other countries actually have proportional representation. And so they're going, yeah, that makes sense. Gee, there's all these different parties in Germany, and there's all these different parties in Israel, and you hear about these coalition governments. Why can't we do that here? We can't do it here because the system isn't built that way. And so I said, come on, Ralph. You know that you're, in effect, lying to my listeners. You know the answer to why we can't have that here. It won't work. You're going to end up with a mess. You're going to end up with George Bush getting elected president, although he wasn't, obviously. We found out after the vote was finally counted in Florida. But nonetheless, that's what you're going to end up with. You're going to end up with a spoiler.
He's like, I'm not a spoiler. I took as many votes from Republicans as that.
It doesn't matter. And that's why it's so important that, number one, Nader not run in 2008. Number one. And number two, see, we can't get proportional representation in the United States because you'd have to amend the Constitution. The last thing we want to do is have a constitutional convention and let the cons get in there and get their hands on our Constitution. So, number two, let's do the next best thing. Let's do what Australia and New Zealand did. Let's do instant runoff voting. It works in San Francisco. It works in communities all over the. It's over 300 communities in the United States, largely as the result of pressure from the Green Party. And this is where I really tip my hat to the Green Party, even though, you know, again, here I am picking on Ralph Nader, who is running as a Green. But, you know, they've done at the local level, they've done some really, really, really good stuff. And instant runoff voting is one of the most important. So anyhow, Ralph Nader's thinking of jumping into the race. We'll see how it shakes out. It's going to be a wild ride. It's going to be a really wild ride. And then also, you know, as he says, the press and the polls are gravitating on cash register politics. Who's going to raise the $100 million or $200 million, McCain or Obama or Hillary? That's very unhealthy. That's rancid politics. I agree. This is why we need public funding of elections. It's very simple. And if you could get around the First Amendment, and obviously you can't, but if you could get around the First Amendment, we could do like they do in England and say, okay, you can't spend more than $100,000 on an election, period. I think it's £100,000 for the House of Commons in the UK. And that's why their elections only run 6 weeks long. I mean, how long, you know, you spend £100,000, 6 weeks, bang, it's gone. But now we've got an entire election industry, and it's kind of incestuously interpenetrated itself with the media in the United States who make, I mean, you know, all these billions of dollars that get raised by these politicians, where do they end up? They end up in the media. So you think the media is going to lead the charge for election reform? Somehow I doubt it. Anyhow, interesting. We'll be back with what's going on in Iraq and your phone calls. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Remember, democracy starts with you. Tag your ears.
There you go, my friends. Isn't it great when they sing songs based on your little out cue or whatever it is? Anyhow, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman program. Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some. You know, then he'll have a whole other set of problems with customs. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Gabe in Las Vegas, New Mexico. Hey, Gabe, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. What's up?
I wanted to comment a little anecdote about the global warming with the polar bears.
Yes, sir.
There's some evidence now that polar bears and grizzly bears are hybridizing. and because the polar bears are being shoved off the ice and going inland. And with that, we're going to see very similar consequence to is with the Florida panther hybridizing with other large cats, the spotted owl and barred owls hybridizing. And,
oh, that's interesting. So nature is adapting.
Yeah.
You know, the species may be reducing in number, but by hybridizing, some of the gene pool is being maintained to survive in the as a consequence of the changes.
Well, yeah.
It's not going to be like the woolly mammoth scenario.
Well, depends if the hybrids can are fertile.
If they're fertile, yeah, unlike mules.
Yeah, exactly. If they're mules, we're going to see a large decrease. If not, we're also going to see a decrease in the species because you lose some of that genetic information.
Sure, sure. And you don't know if the hybrids are going to be more or less well-adapted to compete with the original species. That's interesting.
Exactly.
Gabe, thanks for the heads up on that.
Sure.
That's news I hadn't heard. Jackie in Port Townsend, Washington. Hey, Jackie, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi. I wanted to tell people about an article in the Seattle Times on the 28th of January. And the Puget Sound Blood Center is collecting and storing DNA of blood donors.
Now, I looked that up. Somebody called into this program about that at the time, and I went back and I tracked the story back after I got off the air. And they are doing that looking for, as I read it, for obvious markers of things that it would be dangerous to put into somebody else's blood. They're not doing that by way of identifying people. They're not doing that to gather information for the FBI. This is a medical issue that they're dealing with.
I did call the blood bank because I am a donor, and that's what they said. But the ACLU is thinking that personal information created for one purpose is inevitably used for other purposes and possibly will go into the big, huge database.
Well, if they were pulling all the DNA information out, if they were basically, you know, stripping the genome and saying, here's all the data, then I would not disagree with the ACLU. My understanding is that they were just only looking for very specific pieces of information. You know, is there this particular, you know, for example, is this person a hemophiliac or what, you know, I don't know what it is, but, you know, something like that, some genetically transmitted disease. Although, frankly, you know, thinking about it, I'm not sure why that would matter if you're getting that person's blood. Interesting.
Well, I don't know. I thought it was interesting. The last sentence in the article is, trust the blood bank.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess I do, but still.
Yeah, for the moment. For the moment. But, you know, good on the ACLU for keeping their eye on it. In any case, Jackie, thank you for the call and for raising the issue. Steve in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I wanted to follow up, and I was wanting to talk about progressive taxation. I read an article in USA Today that was talking about how states are veering towards giving tax breaks towards corporations and not giving tax breaks for personal income, and that's creating surplus in 48 states in the United States. Coming from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we've been running into a huge debt because what's predominantly the school of thought is that we've been taxing the corporations out of Pittsburgh, and we're losing all of our jobs. And I just wanted to know, because whenever I'm engaged in conversation, whenever that comes up, is it more for progressive taxation purposes, is it better to advocate maybe a federal mandate for corporate taxes? Is it better to advocate personal income?
The Oregon Center, here's where you go, Steve. The Oregon Center for Public Policy, OCPP.org is their website. The Oregon Center for Public Policy did some really good analysis of this about, you know, why do corporations move from one place to another and what effect does taxation have on it? Because we have among the lowest corporate taxes in the country here. And there are conservatives who argue that we should keep it that way because, you know, we want to keep corporations here. We want to keep Phil Knight happy or whatever. And so, you know, they checked it out. And they did a really – and Steve, I'm sorry. There's a lot of noise coming through your phone, so I'm going to drop your call, but you'll be able to hear my answer. So they did a really thorough analysis of the decision-making process that corporations went through. And it turns out that the major variables that corporations were considering were, A, local resources. In other words, a coal mining company is going to go where there's coal. But B, when it's not that obvious and it's the kind of company that can go anywhere, it was quality of life stuff. Are there good schools so that the employees of this company will want to relocate to that location? Are there good, is there good public transportation? Are there good public facilities? And by and large, those good infrastructure, those positive infrastructure elements are associated with being, you know, are paid for by tax dollars. And so some of the most desirable places to live in the country, some of the places that corporations are the most enthusiastic about moving to, actually have some of the higher taxes. So when you hear these cons talk about, oh, we've got to reduce taxes to get corporations in here, that's nonsense. In fact, it works the other way around. You reduce the taxes, you start destroying the schools. You destroy the schools, the corporations don't want to move there because their employees don't want to put their kids in the schools. 27 minutes past the hour.
Now, I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Incorrigible.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
Yes. Welcome back to the vast liberal conspiracy. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's take a quick look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Following our security developments in Iraq as of 11:15 hours Greenwich Mean Time on Monday, Dateline Baghdad. This is all from Reuters, by the way. A car bomb targeting a fuel station in the religiously mixed neighborhood of Saadiyya in southern Baghdad killed 10 humans, and wounded 62, police said. In Baghdad, a car bomb near a vehicle workshop in the central Baghdad neighborhood of Nada killed 8 people and wounded 40. In Samawa, gunmen killed a policeman and wounded another. In Baghdad, a car bomb exploded near a children's hospital in Andalus Square, killing 1 civilian and wounding 3. In Mosul, police clashed with gunmen in the central part of that city, and 5 civilians were wounded. In Baghdad, Iraqi and U.S. forces killed Khadim al-Hamadini, a top official of radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's organization, in a raid on his home north of Baghdad. In Mosul, a deputy to the governor of Mosul was wounded after a roadside bomb exploded near his convoy. In Basra, a British soldier was killed on Monday by a roadside bomb, taking to 100 the number killed in action in Iraq since the U.S.-led invasion in March of 2003. 100 British soldiers died, dead in total now. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb exploded in Mustansiriya Square in eastern Baghdad, wounded 3 people. Baghdad, a roadside bomb exploded in eastern Baghdad, wounding 2. In Kirkuk, police found a bullet-riddled body with signs of torture in that northern oil city. And also in Kirkuk, in a separate incident, police said they found a body with bullet wounds and signs of torture in the town of Swahan, 15 kilometers north of Kirkuk. Also in Saudi Arabia, the home to 14 of the 19 9/11 hijackers and prime patron of the Bush family, a Saudi Arabian judge sentenced 20 foreigners to receive lashes and spend several months in prison after convicting them of attending a party where alcohol was served and men and women danced together. A newspaper reported Sunday. This is from MSNBC and the Associated Press. The defendants were among 433 foreigners, including some 240 women, arrested by the kingdom's religious police for attending the party in Jeddah, the state-guided newspaper Ozak said. State-guided newspaper. Isn't that a nice euphemism? It did not identify the foreigners, give their nationalities, or say when the party took place. Judge Saud al-Baushi sentenced the 20 to prison terms of 3 or 4 months and ordered them to give an unspecified number of lashes, or to receive an unspecified number of lashes, the newspaper said. Prosecutor generally charged the 20 with, quote, drinking, arranging for impudent party, mixed dancing, and shooting a video for the party, end quote. The newspaper said the rest of those arrested, of the 433, were still awaiting trial. When the Taliban does it, we bomb them. When the Saudis do it, isn't that quaint? Leon in Albany, California. Hey, Leon, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom. I don't know if you've taken a look at the itinerary of the Queen Mary II as to where they're sailing, but they're going to be in the Gulf area right about the time that Bush decides to go into Iraq.
They have,
as one of their stops, in the area, Dubai.
Dubai, yeah.
They will be in the area where all our military ships will be, the aircraft carriers will be, and they will be within target range of Iran.
The QE2.
Yes.
What a tempting terror target.
Well, it is a beautiful target. They carry a...
God forbid.
Well,
geez.
All they have to do is a Tonkin resolution type of thing that they were under attack by some of the rockets that might be coming in from Iran.
Yeah, that's where my thinking was going, Leon.
So the point is this, heads up, because if you remember history, this is exactly according to the peanut plan they have. This is absolutely a guarantee. You can bet your state of throwing Montana over to Europe on this one. This one's going to be a terror attack in and about February or March of this year. I guarantee you that. It's just part of their plan. Why are all those military ships going to be over there? Well, Queen Mary II is in the waters there.
Yeah. I get your point, Leon. I sure hope you're wrong. I sure hope you're wrong. Paul in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Paul.
Yes, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Am I on the air?
You are.
Over the weekend, I saw on CNN a couple things where they're interviewing New York Times correspondents. One was John Roberts of CNN was interviewing, I do believe, John Burns of the New York Times, and the other was Wolf Blitzer with Michael Gordon, the military columnist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were asking about, Iran's influence in the Iraq war and about, some was about these explosives, these sophisticated roadside explosive devices which can pierce the armor and this and that, and how, perhaps this is Iranian technology. The thing is, all those, almost all the deaths of U.S. troops are at the hands of Sunni. It's not Shiite. And especially these...
Previously, devices. I mean, there have been some... There have been times when we've gone after the Shiites. For example, when Bush did his first surge, this so-called surge is the fourth or fifth one. The first one he did was when he went after Sadr in Baghdad 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, whatever that was. And that was when Cindy Sheehan's son, along with five others, were killed by Sadr's men. And then Bush decided, well, I guess we don't want Sadr. So those were Shiites.
Yeah,
but,
that's primarily been small arms and RPG.
Right, but by and large, yes, the Shiites have been saying, we want the country to be stable because we're going to control it now, thank you very much. We are the majority, and this is, isn't that how a democracy is supposed to work? And the Sunnis are going, hey, wait a minute, we used to control this thing, and if we end up just with our own little area, our own little area doesn't have any oil.
Yeah, what was interesting about these New York Times reporters was that they were parsing their comments to, they didn't want to go against what their military sources were saying, well, yeah, this is Iranian influence, but there definitely is money from Saudi Arabia going in to finance the Sunni insurgency, and they didn't.
And has been all along, yeah. And not just Saudi Arabia, probably the other Sunni countries as well, the UAE, Qatar, Dubai, Jordan. I mean, I'm not sitting here with specific evidence, but I think it's fairly predictable that the Sunnis are supporting Sunnis. I mean, certainly you've got 2 million refugees out of Iraq right now, and an awful lot of them are in the Sunni countries, and so presumably they're Sunnis. They've moved into Saudi Arabia and into Jordan in particular. And I've noticed that too, Paul, that the mainstream media is, in some cases, they've even created logos, about Iran, the danger of Iran. They're just so excited to have a war. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it, Paul. Carolyn in Lake Forest Park, Washington.
Hi, hey, Tom. Just a quick follow-up on the Puget Sound blood bank issue.
Yes.
The article also noted, and this is the thing that made me uncomfortable, that the grant that is funding this is the Department of Defense, and it's being administered by the Department of Defense, not Health and Human Services.
Now, could that be because DOD figures, hey, if this works, this is some, you know, they deal with an awful lot of blood themselves. The DOD probably has this, well, not probably. They have the second largest healthcare system in the United States in the Veterans Administration, that it's something that they'd want to do in the VA as well.
Well, that may very well be true, but it still causes a degree of discomfort, and yeah. Not just for me alone.
Yeah, no,
and
I'll agree with you on that.
And I think, you know, in Seattle, which is very blue, it just shows poor judgment on the part of the blood bank to risk losing donors over a study like this. And I'm sure we're not the only blood bank that's part of this.
Yeah. Well, if anybody from the Seattle Blood Bank is listening and would like to call in, our number is 1-866-440-THOM, and we'd be glad to take the call. Carolyn, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. Jim in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Jim.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hartman, and thank you very much for the good work that you're doing.
Well, you're welcome, and please call me Tom, and we have about a minute before we have to take a break.
Yes,
what's
sir.
Up?
Well, my issue is about public financing of elections that you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
And from what I understand, most of that money goes to ads over the airways. And I was always under the impression that the airways were the public domain.
Yes.
So
and
why
this
why can't the folks that are serious, seriously running for office, why they can't be given this time, as opposed to having to pay for it? And
well, it used to be that way.
Huh?
It used to be that way. The Kennedy-Nixon debate was not paid for by anybody.
I mean, so how did it get changed over? I mean, I don't understand what our people are thinking about, that we've got to get the money out of the issue.
Reagan in 84 and 86 began this process of sort of privatizing and auctioning off the airwaves, and then Clinton really drove the final nail into it in 1996 with the Telecommunications Act. And now you have a situation where there's no longer a requirement that radio or television stations carry public debate, political debate. It is a very watered-down suggestion, shall we say. And that's one of the things that's being discussed right now, you know, in the halls of Congress. 45 minutes past the hour.
Was right and not political code. Where leaders in D.C. still respected you and me. The America my daddy taught to me.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Eric in New York City. Welcome to the program, Eric.
Hey, Tom. I'll try to be brief as possible. My question was about the coverage of the war, I guess, really about the media. It's, like, really upsetting and disturbing, and I fall for it myself, too. They want to give the impression that, oh, okay, you know, maybe there's a few attacks a day on our people, and a few of our people die, which is horrible enough. Yeah. But it's like what I hear, I mean, you know, there's hundreds of attacks a day, some days.
Yes.
And grievous injuries. I think I heard, you know, I heard secondhand information from a surgeon that he has to remove a guy's genitals like every other day.
Ouch.
You know, and like, you know, so it's just that was basically my question.
Yeah,
I think we've got
something like 70. Something like 70,000 seriously wounded.
Right, and there's also about the fudging of the numbers about the casualties. I mean, 3,000, yeah. It's like they don't count. There's some question as to whether or not they, if you die in, say, Ramstein, Germany at the airbase from an injury.
Well, there was the story we did last week.
It could be many, many more than 3,000, but that's something else to...
Yeah. No, yeah. It's a good point, Eric, and it is getting downplayed. And it's like the story we did last week about the guy who came back and called up the VA and said, I'm thinking of committing suicide, and they said, well, you're number 26 in line. And he tried three times, actually, to get into a VA hospital and get some help. And they kept telling him, well, just wait another few more weeks, and finally he hung himself. Not good. Charlie in Brattleboro, Vermont. Hey, Charlie, welcome to the program.
Charlie?
Hi. Charlie. That's you, right?
I think so.
Okay, what's up?
Well, I lived in Saudi Arabia for about 3 years, and I'm well aware of what they do for people that catch drinking.
Uh-huh.
And typically, it's 60 days in jail and 80 lashes.
Ouch.
Huh?
Ouch.
Well, the lashes are more symbolic than they are painful.
I see.
It's almost a joke. The guy doesn't even crack his elbow.
Yeah, it's kind of a public humiliation.
The Saudis, it very definitely is that.
Yeah.
You know, they'll be covering their faces, and you'll see the Brits and the Americans that are up there on the platform, and they're waving to their friends, and it's kind of ridiculous, really.
Yeah.
But the point of it all is that these people certainly knew that what they were doing was illegal,
mm-hmm.
and they wouldn't have been busted unless they were making a racket.
I see.
Because the cops know that this stuff goes on, but if it's quiet, they don't want trouble.
Yeah, but what do you think about my point, Charlie, that when the Taliban says, I mean, they also have public beheadings, you know, once a week, and every Friday
and they
cut hands.
Well, yeah, every week, but they're scheduled on Fridays.
Right, and they cut off hands and feet there and things like that. When the Taliban did that,
hands, yeah.
Okay, when the Taliban did that, that was our justification to take them out, right? Because they offered to give us Osama bin Laden. They said, you know, we'll give you this guy. They wouldn't give it to the United States. They'd give him to a European country, to a third country. If you'll hold an actual trial and convict him, then you can have him. You know, and Bush said, no, we won't take him. We want to bomb you guys because you're the Taliban. And oddly, you know, the Taliban suppressed all the growth of opium. The heroin supply
Absolutely.
In the world started drying up because of the Taliban. But Bush's rationale was, no, they cut people's hands off and they're barbaric. And yet when the Saudis do this,
they do the same damn thing. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Been doing it for 1,300 years.
Yeah,
probably longer than that.
My point exactly. We're very selective about who we'll go along with and who we want. Charlie, thanks
Absolutely.
For the call and for the heads up. I appreciate it. It's an interesting story. Kip in Santa Fe. Hey, Kip.
Hi there. I've enjoyed you at all hours of the day and night for several years.
Thank you, Kip.
My point is here in Santa Fe, we have a resolution going through our state senate. It's called Joint Senate Resolution 5. And it's to issue state-level articles of impeachment against Bush and then forward them up to our Washington delegation.
Right. This is happening in some 20 states right now.
Well, that's the point of my call. It would be very good for me because I'm trying to help our senator who's pushing this to testify at the hearings and the other things that are needed. Could you ask listeners to call in and verify that is happening in their states?
I just saw a news. I have a news story on it around here someplace. I'm surrounded by. It looks like a small explosion of paper right now. But
sounds like my desk.
Yeah, but I'm telling you, Kip, with 5 minutes on Google, you'll be able to track it down. Just Google the news. Don't Google websites. You know, go to Google and click on news and do state impeachment resolutions. And you will find it, I guarantee you.
Well, that's very helpful because I think those of us who are working on it in our individual states need some sort of support and backing up here and incentive from that sort of news.
Yep, I got it.
And we'll do that.
Got to move along. Good luck, Kip, and thanks a lot for listening in. Chris in Pittsburgh, we got to wrap the show here.
Hey, Tom, I'll be real quick. Great show. Hey, with regard to the Puget Sound Blood Bank,
I just
wanted to remind you that the second largest health system in America is the Department of Veterans Affairs. Now, that's distinct from the Department of Defense.
Oh, really?
Yes, indeed. They have their own separate budget. It's a separate cabinet-level position and everything. So I think you have reason to question the issue of DOD involvement with blood types and genetics and so forth.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. I stand corrected.
You're quite welcome.
And educated.
Listen to you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, well, thank you. Gee, I'll tell you, I have the smartest listeners in the world. The smartest people on the planet visit our chat room, and the smartest listeners in the world call our program. Thank you so much. Coming up on tomorrow's program, the top news of the day, plus hang on as gun advocate Larry Pratt and I debate the expansion of the Brady Bill. Michael Pettit is here asking the question, are red state children at greater risk than blue state children? That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. And don't forget, my friends, never forget, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.